For these first couple days of the retreat, we've pretty much directed our attention to the body and breath, as a way to help just kind of stabilize and settle the attention in the present moment. We've talked a little bit about what's going on in the mind. And tonight, we're going to start to turn more intentionally. We're going to turn our attention a bit more towards what's happening in the mind. Tonight, tomorrow, with mind states, emotions, thoughts, etc., like just directly turning towards those experiences. Tonight, we'll start with, I'll say a few words, and then we'll stand, and then do some formal practice with what are called the five hindrances. These are five common mind states, so they're in the category of mind states. Very common. Our minds can be quite habituated towards them. And they're called hindrances because when they are present and not noticed, okay, so that's the not noticed part is like, that should be flashing. When they're not noticed, they hinder us. And what do they hinder? They hinder the ability of the mind to be settled and in the present moment, and they hinder the mind's ability to see clearly. So when they're not noticed, they're doing these things. Oh, maybe I should say what they are. They include, and there, you can remember them, that there's two pairs and doubt. So the first pair is wanting and not wanting, the mind that wants and the mind that doesn't want, also known as desire and aversion, okay? And then the next pair is, it's called sloth and torpor and restlessness. So both of these can be in the body and in the mind as well. So I believe sloth is just when the body is really tired, but torpor is in the mind. It's like this unwillingness to connect. And the analogy that I like for torpor is, let's say it's like your day off and you don't have to go to work. And you wake up, it's in the morning, whatever time it is, you wake up. And, you know, there's the possibility of getting up, right, and kind of engaging in the day. And the mind goes, no, no. And it turns away, right? It turns over, goes to sleep. It turns away from connecting. That's torpor in the mind. And it can be like that, not just when we're in our bed, but when we're meditating. There's this sense of, like, not wanting to connect. Okay, so that's torpor in the mind. And then sloth is the body that's very sluggish. And as some of you have mentioned, restlessness, yes, in the body, also in the mind, kind of agitated, flittering quickly, inability to settle. So desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and then the fifth one is doubt. Doubt is perhaps is seen as the strongest of all the hindrances. And this is borne out in the mythology, right? Mythology is a way to understand things, basically. And the night that the bodhisattva, he wasn't the Buddha yet, the bodhisattva sat under the Bodhi tree and meditated and woke up. Well, during that night, Mara, who is the personification of greed, hatred, and delusion, gave him a visit and tried to keep him from becoming enlightened. And of course, again, this is just a personification of what happens in our mind. So Mara tried greed and all this sense pleasures and women, and you can have all of this. And the Buddha's like, no, I got this. Then he tried fear, which is under aversion, and attacked him with terrible monsters and armies and flaming arrows. And the Buddha was just like, no, I got this. So Mara's like, wow. This dude means business. Okay. Wow. I'm going to have to pull out my trump card. I'm going to have to play my last thing, my most serious weapon. And that's when he said famously to the Buddha, what right do you have to be sitting there, here, and trying to instill doubt? And so even after desire and aversion were conquered, doubt was still there. So this doubt is a very strong hindrance. We can doubt ourselves. Have you noticed that ever? You know, our ability to do the practice. Everyone else is calm, and I'm the only one here with my mind kind of all over the place. Or just kind of doubt, like, yeah, they all got here like because they really wanted to be here, but I kind of just stumbled into this. I'm not really, you know, right? That one. Doubt ourselves. We can start to doubt the teachings, like, I don't know. This is the right thing for me, and you know, maybe it's not, but we can doubt the teachings. We can doubt the teachers. He doesn't look so enlightened to me. Shouldn't he be wearing like white, like flowy things or something? But you know, all the ways that doubt can arise. And when it's not noticed, it will like grind our practice to a halt. And literally, when not noticed, and if it really gets traction, it literally makes people stop practicing. Whether it's I can't do this, or this is stupid, or they don't know what they're talking about, like literally just turn away from practice. That's what Mara wants us to do, again, in the mythology. These are the five hindrances, and when not noticed, they are very powerful. They really can have a strong influence over our hearts and minds, and consequently, our speech and our action as a result. But when they're noticed, they really can lose their power. And the analogy I like to make is if a thief wants to steal something, you know, in the night, in the dark, undercover, and they can do what they want and take what they want, right? But all of a sudden, if someone shines a light on them, then, like, they're caught and they lose their power. So when there's no mindfulness, there's no awareness of a hindrance, they hinder, they do. Once we become mindful of them, they're simply an object of mindfulness, like a breath, or a sound. It's just what's being known in the moment. So this is the power of mindfulness, to take something like doubt, which could literally derail our practice, and then through mindfulness know it, oh, this is just doubt. This is just a hindrance. I actually don't have to believe it. And it can really shift. And, you know, not to see them as bad or even less than. They just do what they do. They're just doing their job. You know, when someone says, if we have a problem with someone and they say, hey, you know, the problem's with you. They're just being themselves. You got to see what, you know, why you have a problem with them. Yeah, you've heard that? Well, the hindrances are just being the hindrances. They're just doing what they're doing. They're not bad or wrong. Our job is to be aware of them. And moreover, and here's maybe even more important, that they are not distractions to our meditation. Oh, if I got to just get rid of this desire, oh my God, I've got all this lust in my mind, I just somehow get rid of this, then I can meditate. That's wrong view. That's not a correct view of what Vipassana meditation is. There are no distractions in Vipassana meditation. There are no occurrences or things that can arise in our body, in our mind, in our life that are outside of our meditation. Such a thing does not exist. The description of Vipassana meditation is to see clearly. The word Vipassana, that's the translation of the Pali, to see clearly. It just says to see clearly. It doesn't say see this, don't see that. You should see this, you shouldn't see that. to see clearly what? Whatever's happening. And if a hindrance is happening, then our job is to see it clearly. And if we do, we're practicing. We're doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing. I want to read you something from the texts here. We haven't done that yet. So, and just to kind of point to what I'm saying here. This is a particular set of collection of the suttas, you could say sermons, you know, words of the Buddha. It's called the Middle Length Discourses. And there's this one particular sutta called the Foundations of Mindfulness, and basically everything that we can know is divided into these four sections. And one of the sections is the mind, mindfulness of mind. And this is the Buddha's words, and this is the Buddha instructing us on how to meditate with what's in the mind. Okay? So just keep that in mind. These are like meditation instructions. And they're going to hear the word bhikkhu. Bhikkhu, you could, like, someone who is an earnest practitioner. Could be a monastic, but it doesn't have to be, ultimately. Okay. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind? Here, a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust. You know, as an example of wanting. Mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust. And a mind unaffected by lust as a mind unaffected by lust. They understand mind unaffected by hate, not wanting, as mind affected by hate. And a mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. They understand concentrated mind as concentrated mind, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated mind. So do you hear anything in that where the Buddha's saying, you should see this and not see that? No, not at all. He's saying, if it's like this, notice it. If it's like that, notice that. Very important, this piece right here to get. Or we start setting up our experiences as some of it is worthy and some of it is not worthy. And then we're battling with ourselves, and that's really antithetical to the Vipassana practice. So the Buddha's saying, if there's wanting in the mind, notice that there's wanting. Sitting there dreaming about winning the lottery, all of a sudden mindfulness arises, and it's like, oh, right. Oh, wanting, desire. Okay. Sitting there thinking about how you're going to tell your friend what you think of them because they made fun of you before retreat. Oh, not wanting, aversion. Oh, okay. You're just like, oh, when's the bell going to ring? It's like, oh, I'm so done with this. Oh, torpor, the mind kind of not wanting to connect or whatever. It's just, oh, that's what that is. There's this kind of a dear elder teacher in one of the main lineages that informs our practice here, the Thai forest tradition. His name is Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn just means teacher, or like not just teacher, but revered teacher in Thai language. So Ajahn Sumedho says, his really wonderful teaching that he left us with, he's still alive but not teaching so much, is he said, it's like this now. To whatever arises, whatever. Oh, it's like this now. So pithy, so profound. Our practice is to notice when the hindrances are present and when they're not. That's our practice. Over time in seeing this, just in the seeing, we'll start to see that when they're present, as compared to when they're not present, it'll kind of be like, we like it when they're not present more. It's actually kind of better. We just start to notice that. And the heart and the mind, because we want, as sentient life forms, we don't want to suffer. We want to be happy. That's built in. We don't have to procure that. It just is. When we see actually what leads to happiness and what doesn't, or to the degree, it's not just like an on or off switch, to the degree that we start seeing clearly, right, vipassana, start seeing clearly, we will start to gravitate towards what brings us happiness. We may be a little bit slow on the draw as human beings. It takes us a while, but we're not completely stupid. And once we really start to see, we will naturally gravitate. Wisdom will just start to steer the ship in that direction. So we just see when they're present, see when they're not present, and we'll naturally get a sense of, oh, what's that like? Because we'll be experiencing it in the moment. We'll be mindful of it as it's happening, and therefore we will experience what it's like when they're present and when they're not present. Specifically this wanting and not wanting. This is, Jean was talking a bit about that last night. This is really the core of what makes human beings suffer. This habit pattern in our mind to want and not want. And just to, again, this is not about judging them or us or anything. It's about discerning. So important, very important, which I won't go into. I have a talk on Dharma Seed, a whole talk on the difference between discernment and judgment that I would recommend. But discernment is, in Dharma context, discernment simply knows what leads to happiness and what doesn't. That's it. That's all it means. Whereas judgment is, now we're in the realm of right and wrong, good and bad, etc. So discernment will start to see that, oh, when certain things are in our mind, that's not so good. And when certain things are absent in our mind, much better. Very holistically, organically, over time, that will naturally happen just through sitting here, paying attention to what is. It's so fantastic. It's so simple, this practice, yet so profound in what it reveals. So while they're not bad, we start to become clear that they're not for our well-being. It's not for our well-being to be lost in wanting and not wanting. It's not for our well-being to just keep turning away from life and not engaging. It's not for our well-being to be doubting ourselves and not even knowing it and having that pull the levers and switches of our lives. Self-doubt. Tremendous suffering. That's me, how I know. From self-doubt when it's not seen and kind of in control. So we just organically start to see these things. You know, in fact, you could boil what the Buddha taught down to this. Look and see. Like, pay attention first. Pay attention. This is great. What's that book by Sylvia Boorstein? Pay Attention for Goodness Sake? Anyone see that? What a great title. Pay attention for goodness sake. So pay attention and see what you do that ends up making you feel bad and suffer and or others. And then stop doing that. Yeah? Did you see the Buddha going, stop it? But literally, stop doing that. And then pay attention and see what you do that is for your own welfare and happiness and or of others. And keep doing that and do that more. Very pragmatic. You know, Sometimes when we can be new to meditation, it's like, oh, wow, yogis, levitating in caves in the Himalayas, you know. It's much more pragmatic than that. All right. Let's do a little standing practice now. So let's come to standing mindfully, embodied. All of a sudden we're standing and we don't know how we got there. I guess we're a little bit on a little Qigong theme today. So this is a standing posture in Qigong that I learned on retreat from a teacher. It's called Wu Qi, or the empty stance. And I mean, basically we're going to be standing here, but just to say that there are Wu Qi masters that just do this for like their whole life and study just this posture, just this pose. And this will also help us hopefully feel into and understand our posture a little better. So starting, and if you're on a mat, maybe you might want to go on the floor just because it's not as wobbly. Just have your toes pointing straight forward and your feet about hip width, so not too close. And we'll bring our attention to the bottoms of the feet and our connection with the earth. Feeling the connection and the sensations, but also feeling the support. This is also important. Almost it's like feel that solidity underneath you, almost like it's rising up to meet your feet. And this is important to feel that, like, the earth's got you. And it helps us to actually let go into it when we can feel that support from underneath. And now just bring your attention to the bottoms of your feet and just see that your weight is evenly distributed. So in terms of front to back and side to side on the feet. So it's very, very flat. And now bring your attention up to your ankles. We're gonna build from the bottom up. And if I were to say to you, have soft ankles, what would that be like? Soft ankles. You might move them a little bit just to see. And part of this stance is also about energy flowing. So in Qigong, we want our, and also in Tai Chi, we don't want our joints locked. We want them soft, which helps the energy to flow freely through the body. Flat feet, soft ankles, up to the knees, just the knees being unlocked. Unlocked to slightly bent. And we're going to do a little experiment here. Bring your attention to the bottom of your feet, and now keep your attention at the bottom of your feet while you follow my directions. Lock your knees. Now unlock your knees. Do you feel the difference between the connection with the earth? One more time, lock your knees. It's like we're kind of floating almost. Now unlock your knees. Ah, there it is. Okay, so flat feet, soft ankles, unlocked knees. And then we're going to tuck the pelvis under as though we had a tail and we were going to tuck it under our legs. Or another analogy is there's a chair behind us and we go to start to sit down. And just stop after like a quarter of an inch of movement. There. Almost like we're sitting into this stance. And we want to get a sense now that, so this is our platform, this lower body, and just a sense that it's not even two legs on the ground, it's just one pillar. And now from the stable platform, bringing our attention to our backs. How often do we have our attention on our backs? And the sense of the back rising up from this platform. And remember I talked about the two fingers from behind going up your spine and pushing forward slightly as they do to help the back get a sense of rising up. And the head resting right on top of the spine, so not forward or back or side to side. Now to help fine-tune our stance, we're going to imagine that there is a line that goes from the crown of our head down through the middle of our body and out through the perineum. And this line is perfectly plumb to the earth, vertical. And if our upper body were to coalesce around that line, what would that be like? To help, again, with the flow of energy, we're going to bring our attention now to where the four limbs meet the torso. So where our arms meet our torso, that kind of seam there, we want it to be open. So we want our upper, talked about this when we did the posture a bit, right? Maybe just dropping the shoulder blades down the back. And the sense of that seam where the arms meet the torso is open. Not closed like a book, but a book that's open. And then the seams where our legs meet our torso. And a way to get a sense of that being open, and maybe it's energetically, not even movement, just very lightly bring a little bit of your weight onto the outsides of your feet, the outer edges. What does that do to that seam? Can you feel that? It's just slightly energetically open. And lastly, the arms are in such a way that if we had like a little bird's egg in our armpit, that we wouldn't want to crush it. What would that be like? How would we hold our arms if we didn't want to crush that little bird egg? And this is basically the stance, the Wu Qi. A solid pillar rising up from the earth. The pelvis tucked under, back rising up, the four seams open. And this is a great way to do standing meditation. And we kind of know when we you'll know when you've got this kind of, you're getting into the realm of really settling into this, a feeling will come over you and it'll be like, I could stand like this forever. Very solid, very relaxed, great position to meditate in. But we won't stand for the rest of the, in case you're worrying, oh no, he's going to make us keep standing. We're going to sit down, but we're going to sit down and see if we can kind of mimic this, at least energetically, this posture. So let's mindfully come to sitting. Unless you'd rather stand, please feel free to continue standing meditation. For those of you who have taken the seated posture, feeling the earth underneath you, it's just like rising up to meet you, solid, the sense of that you can let go into it. The back rising up from that stable platform, head resting on top of the spine, and the four seams feeling, at least even energetically, like they're open. And we'll practice with, using our home base of body or breath, or if you use sounds as kind of, again, our home base, basically hanging out there and noticing that when nothing much else is happening. And then when we become aware of a hindrance, we simply note it. You don't have to go looking for it. This isn't about trying to find one. It's simply being clear when one is present, once we've come to know it, especially wanting and not wanting. Note it, and then go back to the anchor. And if you find yourself standing or sitting and things are just kind of quiet, nothing much happening, you might notice what hindrances aren't present. Remember, that's part of the practice. Oh, there's no desire right now. Oh, my energy's fine. I'm kind of like, I'm not jonesing for the sit to be over. Oh, sloth and torpor is not here. Oh, I'm kind of calm and settled. Wow, no restlessness right now. So just practice in this way for this sitting. Noticing when hindrances are there and when they're not there. when we have a walking period, and there's instructions given during the sitting period, generally the instructions remain the same for the walking period. So for this walking period, using the feet as your anchor, the way you would body sitting or body breathing while you're sitting, and then noticing, are there hindrances in the mind, or is the mind free of hindrances? And you don't have to wait till you're walking to practice with that. You know, it's a walking period. Oh, great. Last walking period was very, really cool. Oh, I don't know if it's 30 minutes or 45 minutes. I hope it's 45 minutes. Oh, desire. Or walking period. Oh, aversion, not wanting. Or, I still don't get this walking. I don't know, what am I supposed to be doing? I can't get this. Oh, doubt. And then we'll come back at 9 for our evening chanting and last sit.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.